Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality and not illusion or delusion that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And, of course, if you're out there across America listening to us, why, we'd love to hear from you at 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or if you're here in the Central Coast at 464-8295. But we're not going to take any calls this one specific program because we have with us Dr. James Herson, a professor of law at Trinity College of Law, and we're going to be talking about the amazing, amazing Constitution. And you have to understand, the major problem we have today is that most of our elected representatives, although they have sworn an oath to uphold the Constitution, don't understand the Constitution, don't believe in the Constitution. They believe that they can do whatever they want to because they've been elected without understanding that the Constitution was designed to limit what the government could do. In fact, it was Thomas Jefferson who said, who spoke of the chains that the Constitution placed upon the activities of politicians. In matters of politics, speak not to me of faith in men, but rather bind them down for mischief with the chains of the Constitution. And it was others, philosophers, who said that government governs best that governs the least, because liberty and limited government were synonymous, and tyranny and total government were synonymous. And the reason that we had the most freedom that any people have ever had throughout all history was because of our amazing Constitution. And that's what we're going to be talking about tonight. Dr. Herson, are you there?
I am, Dr. Stan. It's a pleasure to be with you. Let's restore those chains.
Let's get them back on. Well, when we last spoke, we were just getting down to Section 8 of Article 1 of the Constitution, which I believe is certainly one of the most important parts of the Constitution. So I'm going to let you pick up and run with it at this point.
Sure. I mean, we talked a little bit about original intent and how important that was in the historical context and the Federalist Papers, and we went through Article 1, which established part of Article 1, which established Congress, and hopefully we'll get into Article 2. And as you said, Article 1, Section 8, in a sense, it may be the heart of, for sure it's the heart of Article 1, and in a sense it may even be the heart of this section, the body of the Constitution, because it brings up such an important concept, and that we touched on last time. It's called enumerated powers, and the courts have referred to it that way, especially the early court decisions. And what it is, it's part of this idea of limited government. It's the idea that the federal government is granted only those powers that are specifically enumerated. And the primary source of enumerated powers is in the legislative branch, which was intended by the Founding Fathers to be the strongest branch. They've relinquished that mandate, you know, in current times. And one of the ways that enumerated powers works is just by reading this section and seeing the specifics of what the Founding Fathers granted and what's not there. And what isn't specifically granted, Congress doesn't have. There's another kind of additional concept that relates to that, and that where there's been abuse of this area, and it's called delegated powers, where the courts have said that the legislative branch can go ahead and delegate, and that's where they've created all of these agencies, one after another, where, in essence, Congress is avoiding making decisions and delegating some of those decisions to so-called regulatory bodies like the EPA and the Department of Commerce and the Department of Education, Department of Energy, etc. And in early decisions of the Supreme Court, and certainly from the Founding Fathers' point of view, this idea of delegating the law-making power was absolutely forbidden. The idea of it was exclusive to the legislative branch, as we read, all legislative power herein granted. But the one area that I wanted to start with is the very first part of Section 8, and it's very important. The Congress shall have the power to lay and collect taxes, duties, imposts, and excises, to pay debts, and provide for the common defense and general welfare of the United States. But all duties, imposts, and excises shall be uniform throughout the United States. Now, this is something, you know, we could devote an entire program to every one of these sections, but I wanted to spend a little extra time on this one. And the reason is because the first issue it brings up is taxes. And taxes are such a big issue, and it's important for people to understand that taxes were different at the time of the Founding Fathers. For example, there's nothing in here that talks about an income tax as we know it today. And when we get to the amendments, we'll see the Constitution had to be amended to have an income tax. There were basically, in the United States at the time of our birth, two kinds of taxes. There was an indirect tax, which was the main tax, and it was tariffs, user fees, imports, export duties, and that's what paid for our national budget. And the second form of tax was called a direct tax. That was a tax on the person, and it was to be used only when there was an emergency. And basically, it worked like this. The Congress would pass a direct tax in the form of a revenue act, and then that would be passed to the states, and the states would have to pay the debt equally in proportion to the population. So if larger states would have to pay more, and the states were permitted to raise the money any way they chose. So the federal government had no say in how it was done as long as the states paid their share. And once they paid it off, that revenue act for that one emergency purpose went out of existence. So, for example, in 1798, this procedure was used to pay off the debt for the Revolutionary War. And they passed a revenue act which amounted to about $2 million, and each state was given a proportion of that bill, if you will. And once it was paid off, the act went out of existence. Now, they then, you know, later in time, there was an attempt of Congress to pass an income tax, which the Supreme Court overruled, necessitating finally in 1913 this 16th Amendment. But Dr. Stan, I can't tell you how many terrible nightmare stories I have run across of human suffering because of misunderstanding and perhaps of good-intentioned people in this area of income tax. And I think you know what I'm talking about. There are people that have done various diligent scholarly research and come up with theories of why the tax system is illegal. And they'll advise people that it's illegal. And there's a number of different theories. We don't even have time to go into them all. But one of the theories is that because income tax was declared unconstitutional in 1895 and no new power of tax was confirmed, there must be no income tax. Others dispute the definition of direct and indirect taxes. And then there's a theory that the 16th Amendment was never really ratified. There's questions about the ratification process going back, and I know there's some scholars that have made the decision that it wasn't legally ratified. But my view is that it's very important to understand the distinction between what I call de facto law, which may be, it may well be illicit law, and theoretically correct law. And because de facto law, or this illicit law, if it has the color of law, and it has the power of the government behind it, people can end up taking advice from these theoretical tax gurus and maybe be correct, but they'll be behind bars. And that's a very, very, you know, important message to get out, because, and there's some people, I've just heard one horror story after another, because the IRS, as we know, has powers. And perhaps they shouldn't have those powers, but they have powers of collection and attachment and forfeiture that other agencies don't have. And when people follow these tax gurus, they're really potentially hurting themselves and their families, and it's not the smart way to go in this area. My view is that, in fact, we should abolish the 16th Amendment, and we should return to the system that our founding fathers gave us, because it's an absolutely brilliant system, this direct and indirect tax idea that was destroyed by the 16th Amendment. And what have we resulted with? Well, we'll get into that when we look at the section on debt. But we've also developed, you know, NAFTA and GATT, which totally destroy the ability of using tariffs as revenue and export our jobs overseas.
Well, one of the things I'd like to just ask you about, and this is the it is this idea that in beginning of Section 8, it says Congress shall have the power to lay and collect taxes, duties, imposts, and excises to pay the debts and provide for the common defense and general welfare of the United States. Now, there are some people who then twist that around and say, well, see, it is the function of government to provide for the general welfare, although in the preamble it said we will promote the general welfare, we'll provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare. Right here it says in Section 8 of Article 1 that it is the function of Congress to provide for the general welfare. Now, that then, of course, justifies the welfare state, or does it?
Well, it's been used, I have to say, it's been used by the Supreme Court. I know that it was used to uphold the Social Security Act, saying this general welfare. But certainly welfare as used in this at this time and in this Constitution did not mean to create this socialistic redistribution of wealth that we now use that term for. I mean, it would certainly, because clearly they didn't intend that, because they didn't even have an income tax, just the system I described that existed, and taxes were certainly a very volatile issue in the discussion in the convention. So this idea of using that term, the general welfare, to mean that means economic support for people that don't work, or some kind of socialistic program, is a misunderstanding, and it denies that view that we talked about last week about original intent. In other words, we look to the Founding Fathers' interpretation, and they didn't use the term welfare to mean what we use it for today.
Amen to that. And so that really is just the introduction to this whole list of things that the government is to do. And in this introduction, they talk about the common defense, in other words, defend our people. And then down below, it tells what you're going to do for the general welfare, all the things, and then what you're going to do for defense. They're certainly not, it would be totally repetitive if in the preamble they were actually laying out the things they're to do. The list of the items, what are there, 16 or 17 of them that they have, those are the things that they will do. The general welfare is just describing the things that will follow. Would that be a fair statement?
Yeah, I think it is a fair statement, and I think it's exactly, general welfare is just an add-on to common defense, but it just means that what the money is used for is the common defense that will benefit the basic general public, and that it's not, it doesn't mean, within the context of limited government that we talked about in enumerated powers, it doesn't mean that general welfare is a loophole or a door which you can open up and say, okay, now what the Founding Fathers meant is that this money that's collected, these duties and excises, can be used for anything that would benefit economically any segment of the public. Then that would mean that they could spend the money for anything.
Sure.
And clearly that's not the intent if you look at the whole of the Constitution.
Right. Well, let's then go ahead. What are these various enumerated powers that were given to Congress?
Well, and that, of course, that's the first one. It has to do with taxation. The next one is to borrow money on the credit of the United States. And boy, have we exercised that power. In 1790, our national debt was $70 million. In 1840, the national debt was $4 million. After the Civil War, the national debt was $2.7 billion. And after World War I, it was $25 billion. I think the national debt now is about $6 trillion. And I think someone had said that if you took a $1,000 bill and you had $1 million worth of $1,000 bills, that's 1,000 of them, that would be 4 inches. And $1 billion would be $1,000, if you had $1,000 bills and just a billion of them, that's 500 feet. $1 trillion in $1,000 bills is 63 miles high. And so we have 6 times 63 miles worth of debt to pay. And, you know, we could go on. When we get to coining money, I'm sure you'll have a comment about where that debt comes from. But it's an outrageous thing that then we celebrate this phony surplus when our financial house has created this terribly burdensome debt, of which now I think it's, 25 to 30% of our budget is paying the interest on this debt.
Right.
And that if it continues, and it has continued this way, and especially after the war in Kosovo, which ate up the whatever surplus, that was really a phony surplus, but we're going to continue to have this debt, and we'll see our children and grandchildren paying 50 or 60% of the budget towards debt. Another enumerated power is to regulate commerce with foreign nations and the several states and the Indian tribes. The Indian tribes are treated like foreign nations, and the reason for that power is before the Constitution, under the Articles of Confederation, the states had been taxing the commerce or trade between each other. And in essence, this prevents the states from interfering with trade between the states and gives that power to the federal government. And but this is the Commerce Clause is another area where, unfortunately, judicial activism has really stretched it completely out of proportion. In other words, where they've encroached on state sovereignty and state rights using the Commerce Clause, saying that anything that's connected with interstate commerce is the jurisdiction of the federal government. And they've used that, you know, in other words, federal regulation that affects a restaurant that's located on a street that gets customers that travel on interstate highways is subject to federal jurisdiction. They use that kind of reasoning.
Is that what's known as the elastic clause?
It's one of them, yes. It's an elastic clause.
And they're really stretching it, in other words.
They're stretching it. It's judicial activism. It's very unfortunate, but that we have that in our history, and it's, you know, it's twisting the Constitution. The next one, an enumerated power is to establish a uniform rule of naturalization. And, you know, even when we went over the Declaration of Independence, one of the complaints against the king was that he tried to prevent people from coming to the colonies. And so and this relates to a real duty that the federal government has that they're not handling now, and particularly here in California, and that has to do with the borders and the subject of immigration. We see our government being subverted by this globalist view of open borders, which was really has Marxist origins and is encouraging the and we see this in the state government, California, being encouraged by the federal government, encouraging this idea of privileges being granted to people that don't follow the law in terms of immigration, that are illegal immigrants. They just passed a law in the Assembly, which is totally unconstitutional here in California, that would make it for illegal aliens to pay the lower tuition that residents pay for public universities.
If you're here illegally, then.
Illegally. So right. That means if somebody moves to California from Kentucky, if they say they're from Kentucky, they have to pay the higher non-resident tuition for at least a year. But if they say that they came here illegally from El Salvador, they can pay the lower tuition. This is the reasoning and the logic that we have. And, of course, we have law professors back east who are arguing that illegal alien voting is the suffrage movement of the 90s.
Right.
So it's an amazing, but this relates to sovereignty and the borders. And then the subject of bankruptcies throughout the United States. Bankruptcy, that came from the English common law tradition because bankruptcy was a centralized idea. And then a big one here, to coin money, regulate the value thereof and of foreign coin, and fix the standard of weights and measures. And, of course, coining money was the idea of money being attached to a substance of value, coin, gold, which our money was up until it was taken off of the gold standard, but that started in 1913 with the passage of the Federal Reserve Act. And I know you've done a lot of programs on the Federal Reserve, which is neither federal nor reserve and is really not a government agency at all, and is, in essence, creating this money by fiat, money out of nothing, and you know, is another area we need to drastically reform and return to the idea, the simple idea of money having a value attached to it.
And, of course, the whole idea of banking is to allow the bankers then to create money out of nothing. If you have something of intrinsic value, which was gold, then, of course, you could not inflate its the amount of gold. You could raise the price of gold and give it more value. But certainly once we got away from the coin, why we allowed a very small group of people then to gain control of our nation. And certainly Thomas Jefferson, many of our original founding fathers, recognized the dangers of a fiat or paper money system, and tragically we've fallen into that trap.
And they warned us of the dangers of central banking.
Absolutely.
Yes, and we have fallen into that trap. And then along with that, to provide for the punishment of counterfeiting the securities and current coin of the United States, which makes great sense because you want to have a standardized money and you want to have a centralized counterfeiting, to establish post offices and post roads. And here's an important one, to promote the progress of science and useful arts by securing for limited times to authors and inventors the exclusive right to their respective writings and discoveries. And this is the section of the Constitution that sets up copyright and patent law. And very important, and the biggest abuser, this is called intellectual property, and the biggest abuser of intellectual property in the world is China. And we don't seem to be enforcing it against China, of course, because it appears as though lately our administration is really a subsidiary or adjunct of China these days. Congress is given the enumerated power to constitute tribunals, courts that are inferior to the Supreme Court. And we have a number of different court systems now. Each state has its own court system to deal with matters that concern state law. But the federal government has a completely different system of courts, and they have their own trial level, which is called the Federal District Court, and it's divided into districts because it covers such a large area, and then there's a federal Court of Appeals, and each one of those has districts that here in California, we're under the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, and then the next level would be appealing to the Supreme Court of the United States. And many people don't understand this, but the Supreme Court exercises its appeal jurisdiction discretionary. It doesn't have to review all the cases sent to it. As a matter of fact, it couldn't. And it selects those cases that it deems the most important from the thousands it receives every year. And there are other some specialized federal courts, but the majority fall into the categories up above. And then to define and punish piracies and felonies committed on the high seas and offenses against the law of nations, the Founding Fathers, this idea of the foreign policy having been conducted by the states, they wanted to consolidate it into the federal government, and the Federalists got their way in that. And so any crimes that were committed on the high seas, at that time they had pirates on the high seas in the late 1700s, and matter of fact, they blackmailed European countries, these pirates, so they wouldn't attack shipping, and the U.S. did the same thing. And but it was the federal government would be in the best position to deal with that sort of thing. And then another very important enumerated power that comes into play in the news constantly, and particularly today, Congress has the exclusive power to declare war. Now, it also says to grant letters of marque and reprisal and make rules concerning captures on land and water. These letters of marque and reprisal are no longer used. They were government documents that authorized an individual to arm a ship and capture enemy ships and cargo. But to the exclusive power to declare war has been increasingly ignored by presidents. Previous presidents before Bill Clinton at least attempted to frame their deployment of military as an exception, because even the Founding Fathers said that this power to declare war, that the president, there would be an exception if it was necessary to repel a sudden attack in an emergency. And as a matter of fact, the original language of this section was to make war, but they changed it to declare war because of that reason, because they wanted to have an exception in terms of leave a spot open for the executive to repel a sudden attack. And then, of course, in the Vietnam era, Congress passed the War Powers Resolution of 1973, which had these exceptions, which were essentially exigent emergency type exceptions. This current situation in Kosovo does not fall into any of the exceptions, and there was a 60-day time limit on the deployment, which ran out. So it violated this section initially. It violated the War Powers Resolution. 31 members of Congress filed a lawsuit, which is still pending in the appellate level. And it's very sad as we watch these very, very important enumerated powers encroached on and ignored. There's a reckless disregard for this document today.
Amen to that. And, of course, that's one of our big problems, that we have a president who really doesn't believe in the Constitution and is ruling by executive fiat through executive orders, through presidential decision directives. But even more tragic is that the vast majority of congressmen do not have the courage or integrity to stand against him. We're going to have to take our break here, so you have 3 minutes. We'll be back in just 3 minutes' time.